changed. And yet still we have so many people who either don't understand it or refuse to do it or think they know better than the experts or believe the experts are part of some conspiracy. There's a lot of stuff. And we interviewed an author who is a historian of the 1918 flu. And he told us about a lot of the same dynamics, science, skeptical people, people refusing to participate in the guidelines, et cetera. 100 years ago, I mean, 103 years ago at this point in time, some things never change seemingly, or at least they take a really long time to change. Send me your emails. Maybe they will be picked and featured on next week's email bag, info@davidpakman.com. We've got a great bonus show coming up for you today. You can sign up at joinpakman.com. Please sign up. It really is a great revenue source for us. It makes us independent of big media and advertisers, because it's just you guys. You guys control the show. You fund the show. You can sign up at joinpakman.com and use the coupon code BETTER21. We'll see you on the bonus show if you're not so inclined. But
WRCT Pittsburgh, we love monkeys.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
WRCT is on AOL Instant Messenger. Our screen name is WRCT883. Send us a shout out so we can make fun of your atrocious spelling. Send us a request. Send us anything. We're bored. WRCT, 88.3 FM on your radio, WRCT.org on the internet, and now WRCT883 on AOL Instant Messenger. In the language of the kids today, we're the bomb. That's right, isn't it? That's what the kids say. We're the bomb, correct?
Or I'm from creationist crucifixion.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3, arr.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
And your soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, home of... Oh, crap. We're not really home of anything, are we?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh, yeah, bringing you the only fat beat. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Hello, I'm Meg Lee Chin, and when I'm in town, I like to listen to WRCT 88.3 FM.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you anymore.
We at WRCT Pittsburgh do not condone the illegal duplication of copyrighted material. But if you happen to own all the tracks we played and would like a copy of them, just FTP to FTP.
Due to a request by Computing Services, the remainder of this announcement cannot...
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Hi, this is Dean from Luna. You're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT in Pittsburgh.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without...
Alicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
First of all, we were taken as held for ransom. Then I was sold to the CIA as Al-Qaeda general, middle-aged Egyptian, you know, a 9/11 insider. I was taken to the black site, where I was like tortured for over 2 months. Then from the black site to Kandahar detention.
Today we spend the hour with Mansour Adaifi. He was imprisoned at Guantanamo for over 14 years after being sold as a teenager to the CIA by an Afghan warlord after the 9/11 attacks. By the time he was released, he'd spent half his life in U.S. custody, but was never charged with a crime. He'll talk about being tortured and why he repeatedly went on hunger strike to protest inhumane conditions.
We were hurting ourselves. I always tell the people, you know, our bodies was the battlefield, because Americans torture us, abuse us, and beat us. And in our bodies, also we were torturing our bodies by hunger strike, by try to resist. And I wrote about it, the hunger strike. It was a slow journey to death, toward death. That's hunger strike.
Mansour Adaifi will also talk about his new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo, and how art helped him and others survive the prison.
Art connect us to the world outside. You can see the brothers we paint, see trees, the things we missed most: sky, the stars, you know, homes, deserts, and so on.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Del Rio, Texas, a makeshift encampment where up to 30,000 Haitian asylum seekers stayed or passed through was cleared by authorities as the Biden administration continues to expedite its mass expulsion of migrants without due process. At least five deportation flights took off Sunday, with thousands expelled in the past week alone. The International Organization for Migration says dozens of children with non-Haitian passports were among those deported. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said about 12,000 people were allowed to remain in the U.S. to fight for asylum. Meanwhile, an estimated 8,000 Haitians were forced to cross the border back into Mexico after facing violence and being deprived of food, water, and shelter. In Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, demonstrators condemned the inhumane treatment of asylum seekers in the United States.
We're here not to ask for favors from the United States. We're here demanding that they respect that we, as Haitians, as Haitian migrants, have rights. We are demanding that American laws on immigration be applied to Haitians, just as they are applied to those from other countries.
Meanwhile, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry told world leaders at the UN General Assembly that migration will continue as long as massive global inequalities exist. In Germany, the center-left Social Democratic Party has narrowly claimed victory in an election that puts an end to the 16-year era of Angela Merkel's leadership. Merkel's party, the Christian Democrats, won the second most votes, with the Green Party coming in third. Social Democrats will now have to form a ruling coalition, which could take weeks, possibly months. The SDP's candidate for chancellor, Olaf Scholz, who positioned himself as a leader in the vein of Angela Merkel during his campaign, vowed to tackle the climate crisis and modernize industry. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces Sunday shot dead at least five Palestinians, including a 16-year-old child, during overnight raids. In other news from Palestine, political and social leader Khalida Harar has been released from an Israeli prison after 2 years behind bars. Gerar is a leftist activist and a former member of the now-defunct Palestinian Legislative Council. Meanwhile, in New York, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas spoke at the UN General Assembly and said Israel had 1 year to pull out from the occupied territories, threatening to withdraw recognition of Israel if it fails to do so. Abbas also said Israel's actions were driving towards a one-state solution.
If the Israeli occupation authorities continue to entrench the reality of one apartheid state as it is happening today, our Palestinian people and the entire world will not tolerate such a situation. Circumstances on the ground will inevitably impose equal and full political rights for all the land of historic Palestine within one state.
The Pacific Island nation of Vanuatu is asking the International Court of Justice to weigh in on the rights of its people to be protected from the climate catastrophe. Prime Minister Bob Laufman addressed the UN General Assembly Saturday.
Limiting warming to near 1.5 degrees will be beyond reach. The issues are increasingly eluding the control of individual national governments.
Hundreds of thousands of youth climate activists took to the streets Friday for the annual Global Climate Strike. Protests took place across the globe demanding radical action from world leaders to fight the climate catastrophe. This is Maria Reyes, a climate justice activist in Mexico.
Climate crisis is not a thing that will happen in 10 or 15 years. Climate crisis is here. Mexico is one of the most affected countries in Latin America. We have scarcity, we have droughts, we have floods, we have heat waves. We are dying of thirst. We are dying because of heat, and the government is still financing the fossil fuel industry.
In California, firefighters continue to battle multiple wildfires. Police arrested a woman suspected of arson in the Fawn Fire, which erupted in Shasta County last week and led to thousands of evacuations. In the Sierra Nevada mountains, the KNP complex fire is still raging in Sequoia National Park and has blazed through some 45,000 acres. It was just 8% contained as of Sunday. In related news, California utility company Pacific Gas and Electric was charged with manslaughter over last year's Zog fire, which killed four people. In Somalia, al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a suicide bomb attack that killed at least eight people at a checkpoint near the presidential palace in Mogadishu Saturday. Somalis have condemned the government for neglecting security in the country amidst a contested delayed election and ongoing political disputes. In Canada, the Conference of Catholic Bishops apologized for the century-long abuse of Indigenous children at government and church-run schools. The move comes after the remains of hundreds of students were found over the summer at the former boarding schools. But the apology falls short of a recommendation by Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which called on Pope Francis to apologize directly for the church's role in Canada's cultural genocide. In Switzerland, nearly two-thirds of voters cast ballots in favor of same-sex marriage in a referendum Sunday. Switzerland is one of the last countries in Western Europe to approve same-sex marriage. Meanwhile, voters in the Catholic European microstate of San Marino have overwhelmingly voted to legalize abortion in the referendum there. Once enacted into law, pregnant people will be able to access abortions up to 12 weeks of pregnancy and, in some cases, after 12 weeks. San Marino is a small enclave surrounded by Italy. Meanwhile, back in the United States, the House passed the Women's Health Protection Act Friday, weeks after Texas enacted a near-total ban on abortion, and as the Supreme Court is set to consider a challenge to Roe v. Wade later this year. This is California Congressmember Jackie Speier.
We are not vessels for men to inject their sperm into and then walk away with no consequences. This is my body, not yours. Many on the other side of the aisle whine about the freedom that they have lost by having to wear masks. And yet, you want to take my freedom to control my body away from me.
The legislation would enshrine patients' right to terminate a pregnancy and protect providers from state laws that seek to ban abortion. The bill, however, is not expected to pass in the evenly divided Senate. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the House will vote on the bipartisan $1 trillion infrastructure bill Thursday, pushing an earlier deadline that had been set for today. Lawmakers will vote just hours before government funding and some key transportation programs are set to expire. Progressive Democrats said they will not back the infrastructure bill without Congress also approving the $3.5 trillion 10-year spending plan, which expands the social safety net and addresses the climate emergency. The House Budget Committee Saturday moved that measure forward for a House vote. Here in New York City, a federal judge temporarily blocked a vaccine mandate for teachers and other staffers. The mandate was set to go into effect today and will now be reviewed by a legal panel this week. Meanwhile, New York Governor Kathy Hochul says she may call in the National Guard and out-of-state medical personnel to fill in for tens of thousands of hospital workers who have not complied with New York's vaccine mandate for health care workers. In New Mexico, health officials have linked the improper use of ivermectin to at least two deaths. The anti-parasite medication, most commonly used for horses and cows, was widely touted by conservative media and others, even though there is no scientific evidence it benefits COVID patients, and the FDA has warned against its use. In Chicago, workers at El Milagro tortilla plant staged a temporary walkout last week to protest low pay, staff shortages and abusive working conditions, including intimidation and sexual harassment. El Milagro claims an ongoing tortilla shortage is due to supply chain issues, but organizers say the company's lost staff due to their poor treatment of workers, including their mishandling of the pandemic. Last year, dozens of workers got sick during a COVID outbreak and five died. This is El Milagro worker Martin Salas.
All we're doing is demanding our rights as employees of El Milagro. Just as they have rights as employers, we too have rights as workers. I pack 80 tortilla packages per minute. I load a case, put it on a pallet, and come right back. Because if I don't keep up this pace, tortillas will fall off from the machine and they'll blame me.
Workers have given El Milagro management until this Wednesday to respond to their demands. And the pioneering Texas liberal Frances Sissy Farenthold died Sunday at the age of 94. In 1971, as the only woman elected to the Texas House, she led a revolt against corruption, then overcame long odds to become a serious candidate for Texas governor. In 1972, she lost a bid to be the Democratic Party's nominee for vice president.
Do you think at this time a woman could be nominated as a vice presidential candidate?
To me, the pursuit of public office is a corollary to full citizenship.
Sissy Farenthold later led the National Women's Political Caucus to recruit women to run for elected office. She dedicated the rest of her life to nuclear disarmament, human rights in Central America, and abolishing the death penalty. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we spend the hour with Mansour Adaifi. At the age of 18, he left his home in Yemen to do research in Afghanistan. Shortly before he was scheduled to return home, he was kidnapped by Afghan warlords and sold to the CIA after the September 11th attacks. He was jailed and tortured in Afghanistan, then transported to the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo in 2002, where he was held without charge for 14 years, many of those years in solitary confinement. Mansour became known as Detainee 441. In 2016, he was released against his will to Serbia, which he compares to Guantanamo 2.0. By the time Mansour was released, he'd spent more than half his life in prison. Mansour Adaifi has just published a memoir titled Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. I spoke to him Friday from his home in Belgrade. I began by asking him to talk about how he ended up at Guantanamo.
Okay, let's fly back like 38 years, which actually like when people ask me, how old are you? I said like 24 because I didn't count Guantanamo, like try to cheat. Anyway, I born in a tiny village in Yemen, Raima. Born like with 11 brothers and sisters, large family, very conservative family. Until I studied my primary school and secondary school in the village, we had no high school, so I had to go and live with my aunt in the capital Sana'a, which is like New World. When I finished with my high school, I was assigned to do some as the research in Afghanistan. I was like a research assistant in Afghanistan. This is how my journey started there. In Afghanistan, I spent a couple of months researching and doing some of the research required to be done. One day after 9/11, I was kidnapped by the warlord. They were actually interested in the car. They weren't interested in us. Then when American came, the American airplane, they were throwing a lot of flyers offering a large bounty of money. Could it change Afghani's life? So Afghanis found out that the more you give them high-ranked people, the more you get paid. The price ranged between $5,000 to like $200,000, $500,000. First of all, we were taken as held for ransom. Then I was sold to the CIA as Al-Qaeda general, middle-aged Egyptian, you know, a 9/11 insider. I was taken to the black site, where I was like tortured for like over 2 months. Then from the black site to Kandahar detention was one of the funny things. When I arrived at Kandahar detention, I was thrown naked there. It's like another, it's a long journey. Second day of my arrival, guards came to move me to a tent. After the interrogation, I was asked to sign a paper that the Americans have a right to shoot me and kill me if I try to escape. I said, no, I'm not going to sign. Of course, I will try to escape. I shouldn't be in the first place. So yeah, I was beating. I refused to sign. They put my hand on the paper. They signed it themselves. I said, no, that doesn't count. I have to sign with my, like, willingly.
And when you talked about a bounty being paid to the warlords who handed you over to the U.S. CIA, and then you were tortured at a black site. Do you know where that black site was? And when you say tortured, what actually happened to you in that two-month period? If I hate to bring you back there, but what actually happened?
You know, I didn't know where I didn't until that day. I don't know where the black site is, where that place. But I was kept before that at one of the warlord home. I was treated like a guest, teaching his kids classes, math, Quran, and so on. And after that, when American came, they, you know, stripped naked, they put me in the bag, hooded, and they shipped me to somewhere. I don't know. Until that day, so. And the black site, it was one of the worst experience in my life. Sometimes I'm afraid to get back there, not because fear, it's just, you know, to relive that trauma, because there was no limit to whatever they can do to us, 24 hours.
And these were U.S. soldiers?
Yes, U.S. soldiers and with also Afghanis, where people actually lost their life there, because they were looking for where Osama bin Laden, where is Mullah Muhammad Umar, where the new attacks, the sleeper cells. And they have a long list and photos and all kind of things. So, yes, I mean, you know, those black sites, I believe no one knows how many people ended there and how many people actually died there. But there was no limitation to whatever they can do to you. I mean, we spend hang on the ceiling all the time, upside down. Even the we are blindfolded, naked. The food, the drink, they just pour rice and water in our mouth. Sometimes we also do our things while standing, and there is no rest. 24 hours is a programming, like sleep deprivation. We have only sleep. They give you 30 minutes, like then 6 hours, then 20 minutes if you can sleep. Loud music, beating, waterboarding. They used to put us in kind of like a barrel and roll it in the ice and shoe. And the first time I did, I thought I died because they rolled it and they used to they shot with the gun. I like was looking with the holes, but I was still alive. So, yes, I mean.
And so you were taken from there to Kandahar, and then you were held where in Kandahar before being brought to Guantanamo?
I think in Kandahar, we were at the airport. They have a detention. They built a detention prison in Kandahar. It was tents surrounded with, like, high walls of barbed wires. We could see the airplanes taken off and every time. So when we used to see the small airplanes, we knew they bring a new group of people. But we called the big one, we called the Beast, the Air Force, really big one. So that when it came, we all like panicked because we knew some people was going to leave and they're going to disappear. So even that trauma, just waiting for your name to or number to be, no name, to be our name to be called, they took us and they called a process station where they just dragged me to that place, hang in the pool, stripped naked, shaved, and they were all kind of humiliation. I mean, I just too much to talk about it. So when we were packed on orange jumpsuit, everything was orange. Shoes, socks, uniform, you know, shirt, T-shirt, pants, everything was orange. And they have also goggles, earmuffs. My mouth was duct taped, my eyes too, also then hood. And they bought one more thing about special because as big fish, they bought a sign around my neck, which said, beat me. So every 10 minutes, I get beaten all the way for the next over 40 hours until we arrived at Guantanamo.
And what did they say you did? What were the charges against you?
You know, at the black site, I was accused to be an Egyptian. They asked me I was in Nairobi and was recruiting, money laundering. I was Al-Qaeda camp, head of the camp, trainer, commander. All kind of accusation. I tried to deny them, but I admit to everything, you know. But the problem was with the details. I couldn't give them the details. By the end of like 2 months and a half, when they found that I wasn't that person, they just threw me in Kandahar detention. And from Kandahar, the same file were sent with me, where the interrogation started again about the same person. And in Guantanamo over and over and over again.
Now, I want to just be very clear. You were 18 years old.
Yeah, I was 18 years old when I was kidnapped. I turned 19 on the black site.
Former Guantanamo prisoner Mansour Adaifi. We'll be back with him in 30 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Mansour Adaifi, he was imprisoned by the United States at Guantanamo for 14 years. He's author of the new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo.
What people, most people don't know about the purpose of Guantanamo. Let me talk just a little. Guantanamo, as you know, it was outside of the law. They call it the island outside of the law. So the purpose of Guantanamo wasn't about making Americans safe or about safety or security. It was, you know, it wasn't that purpose. So we were called detainees. And as you know, international law doesn't apply. Geneva Convention doesn't apply. American law doesn't apply. Cuba law doesn't apply. Nothing applies at that place. It's just a dark hole, a black site within the military base. So when General Miller arrived in 2000, by the end of 2002, he's the first one who wrote the Camp SOP, Standard Operation Procedure, and he was the first one who started developing what they call enhanced interrogation technique, enhanced torture technique. So we were kept in solitary confinement, experimented on, punished, everything utilized as experiment, our religion, our daily life, food, clothes, medicine, talk, air, everything was used in those experiments. Also, there was a psychologist who supervised those experiments. You know, there was around 800 detainees from 50 nationalities, 20 languages spoken. But, you know, Amy, the youngest detainee was only 3 months old. They brought him with his father. He was kept in the hospital. The oldest detainee was 105 years old. That man was my neighbor. And that what hurt me most at Guantanamo, seeing that man at that age treated like the same I was treated, I couldn't take it. I had to fight every day with the guard to stop treating that way. So, yes, General Miller was his job. There is a research called Guantanamo's America's Battle Lab. Talk about how Guantanamo was turned into an experimenting lab on detainees. So even not just us. There was a chaplain, I think you know about, James Yee. I met him at Guantanamo.
James Yee, yes, was the chaplain at Guantanamo who would come out and talk about what happened there.
No, before what happened to James Yee at Guantanamo shocked and surprised us all. I remember the first time I talked to James Yee, I was taken to the interrogation room, stripped naked, and they put me in a call it a satanic room, where they have like stars, signs, candles, and crazy guy come in like white, crazy clothes, reciting something. So they also used to throw the Holy Quran on the ground, and, you know, they tried to pressure us to, you know, like, they were experimenting, basically. When I met James Yee, I told him, look, that would happen with us that way. James Yee he was protesting against the torture at Guantanamo. General Miller, the one who was actually developing enhanced interrogation technique, enhanced torture technique, so that James Yee as a chaplain is going to be a problem. So he was accused as sympathized with terrorists. He was arrested, detained, and interrogated. This is American Army captain, a graduate of West Point University, came to serve at Guantanamo to serve his own country, was because a Muslim background, he was accused and of terrorism and was, detained and imprisoned. This is this American guy. Imagine what would happen to us at that place. So when they took James Yee, we protested. We asked to brought him back because the lawyers told us what happened for him after like 1 year. We wrote letter to the Camp administration, to the White House, to the Security Council, to the United Nations, to everyone, basically.
When you talked about General Miller, just for people who might not remember, oversaw the enhanced interrogation techniques, that was the euphemism for torture at Guantanamo, then brought from there to Iraq to Gitmoize Abu Ghraib there, to bring those same torture techniques there. And when the Taguba report came out, it cited Miller for the massive level of abuse at Abu Ghraib. In that period, I mean, Mansour Daifi, you write so powerfully about what sustained you, about the relationships you had, not only with other prisoners, or as you say, detainees, but with guards as well. Can you talk about that?
You know, Amy, let me go a little, like, I'd like to make a point here. First of all, we as prisoners or detainees, we weren't just the victims of Guantanamo. They're also guards and camp staff, or also victims of Guantanamo itself. You know, that war situation or condition brought us together and proved that we all human and we share the same humanity first. Also, Amy, a simple question. What makes a human as a human? Make Amy as Amy, make Mansour as Mansour, makes the guys in the as individual and person, you know? What makes you as a human and uniquely is your name, your language, your faith, your morals, your ethics, your memories, your relationship, your knowledge, your experience, basically your family. That's what makes a person as a person. At Guantanamo, when we arrived there, imagine the system was designed to strip us of who we are. You know, even our names was taken or becoming numbers. You're not allowed to practice religion. You're not allowed to talk. You're not allowed to have a relationship. So to the extent we thought if they were able to control our style, they would have done it. So when you arrive at Guantanamo, one of the things people still don't know about Guantanamo, we had no shared life before Guantanamo. Everything was different, was new and unknown and a scary unknown, you know. So we started developing some kind of relationship with each other at Guantanamo, among us like prisoners or brothers, and with the guards too, because when guards came to work at Guantanamo, they became part of our life, part of our memories that will never go away. The same thing. We become part of their life, become memories. Before the guards arrived at Guantanamo, they were told, some of them were taken to the Nail of Insight, Ground Zero, and they were told the one who had done this is in Guantanamo. Imagine when they arrived at Guantanamo, they came with a lot of hate and grudge and revenge. But when they live with us and watch us every day, eat, drink, sleep, get beaten, get sick, screaming, yelling, interrogated, torture, you know, also they are humans. You know, the camp administration, they cannot lie them forever. So the guards also, when they live with us, they found out they're not the men we were told they're about. Some of them, you know, were apologizing to us. Some of them, we form strong friendship with them. Some of them convert to Islam. The military rules is cruel, and they treat those guards as a product, not humans. You know, even those guards, when they, some of them went to tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, when they come back, we saw how they changed. When I grew up, I became my 30s. When they used to bring younger guards, I looked them as like younger brothers and sisters and always tell them, like, please get out of the military because it's going to devastate you. I have seen many people change.
I mean, this is such an important point you're making. You were there when you were 19, and you were still there in your 30s. And then the young people who are there, who are the guards, are the age you were when you first got there.
Yeah, I mean, because when I grew up at that place, when I saw how the guards came back, many of them were mentally devastated. You know, when you see a broken soul, it is painful than anything. You know, even the pain that touched your soul, it is the most severe pain. I have experienced many pain, beating, torture, even you name it. But the worst thing I experienced, that touched my soul.
I wanted to ask you about the hunger strikes. You participated in these for years, and you were force-fed.
You know, I mean, we were in a place, we tried to survive. As I told you, we had only each other. And there is no way, we tried to stop the torture, the abuses, the mistreatment. You know, we tried to find why we were held there, till when it was going to happen to us. So when the first time when I come to X-ray, when they were harsh, stopping us from praying together, one day they came, one of the brothers were praying, they opened his door, they beat him, and they threw the holy book into the floor. So we, you know, this the first protest together. So we discussed among ourselves, what should we do, you know? Okay, the first time I heard about the hunger strike, I never heard about it before, we went on hunger strike. It was, I spent 9 days. It was a mean try to survive. I mean, we were hurting ourselves. I always tell the people, you know, our bodies was the battlefield because Americans torture us, abuse us, and beat us. And in our bodies, also, we were torturing our bodies by hunger strike, by try to resist. And I wrote about it, the hunger strike. It was a slow journey to death, toward death. That's hunger strike, you know. They also become very experienced how to break the hunger strike. We spent almost every year we had like to go through many hunger strikes over and over and over and over again. We first fed in 2005, 7, 2010, 13. Some of the brothers spent 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. There are brothers still until now on force feeding until that day.
And what was that force feeding? Can you describe it? We were just learning about what was happening at Guantanamo at the time, the tubes that were used, how big they were, that this was used as a form of torture as well, what it meant when they were forced to stop force feeding you.
You know, like, as I told you, they were also, the doctors were experimenting on us. They used to bring, they tried to bring the hunger strike. I was one of the very first five detainees who was on the brink of death in 2005, before they approved the force feeding. I remember when the camp commander came, he said, now the Congress, approved the force feeding. When they took us, they bring tubes, they took through our nose. Our nose is like a drill. Bleeding
through your nose.
So and they, through our noses to our stomach. And we at that time we were in bed, you know. Then the situation got worse. They brought something called force feeding a chair, which like they tie our heads, 8 points, our shoulders, our wrist, our waist, our legs, and the force feeding a chair. Then. They brought also really large, they call it nine French tube, really large, and they put it through our nose. We were screaming, shouting, that eat. No, wait, eat. In 2005, they forced all of us to stop the hunger strike. What they did, they used to feed us. Regularly, they should for us twice a day. But when they wanted to bring the hunger strike, they used to feed us five times a day. Nobody can last. They used to bring piles of insure and just pour in our stomach, one after another. We threw up, it doesn't matter. Eat. 8 hours to 12 hours in the force feeding chair.
This is they used to bring the insure through your nose.
Yes. They used to pour the insure, one can after we was to throw up. If you throw up, you get more. They also used to bring some laxative in the insure. We and ourselves on the feeding chair. And we were taken to a certain confinement, really cold AC. They said, I remember that time there's a general who came. He said, I was sent by the White House just to bring to break your hunger strike. The first time he met me, he said, he took my file. Sir, 441, he's so mean. Like you can say in his eyes, in words, he said, I'm here today to tell you, sir, eat, because tomorrow there will be no talking. I tried to explain to him that why you are in a hunger strike. He said like, I don't give a about anything. Eat. Tomorrow there will be no talking. I didn't last for 2 days. I stopped. I couldn't take it. You know, it was too much. In 2007, again, I went on hunger strike. Then I spent from 2007 and 2010 on force feeding until things changed in the camp. And even Amy, our hunger strike was viewed by the camp administration as jihad. They said, we are Al-Qaeda cell and launching jihad against the United States. The way how they understood our protest and hunger strike. And we told them, this is our demand. You know, stop the torture, stop the interrogation, improve the living condition. And we need to figure out what's going to happen to us. So what they did, they used to also hide us when the ICRC came. I remember one day I was in force feeding. The ICRC, his name, Hatim, Sudanese guy. He walked in the block and was like, in the first feeding, I would call him Hatim. He looked at me and he covered his eyes. I said, what's wrong with you? He said, we are not allowed to see you in that way. Even the ICRC at Guantanamo, you know, We asked them to leave many, many years. We boycott them. We give them official letters. We signed many letters asking them to leave Guantanamo, because being at Guantanamo as ICRC, it just gave legitimacy to whatever American do here.
We're talking to Mansour Daifi. He was detainee 441 at Guantanamo, imprisoned without charge for 14 years, and has written a memoir about his life, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. So I then want to ask you about what happened in 2016, why after 14 years without charge, in at 19 years old, now in your 30s, you were released, and how you ended up, a Yemeni man, in Serbia.
I refused to come to Serbia. I was forced. They told me, you have no choice, either leave or rot in here. Then the ICRC, when I protest, I went on hunger strike protesting going to Serbia. The ICRC came here to Mansour. They issued a new, Obama administration issued a new rules. If any detainee accepted by any country, he will be forced to leave regardless. So basically, I had no choice. They bought me with money, and they give the Serbian government money to take me again. So this is the game. We have no say.
And so you end up in Serbia. You end up in Belgrade. I was just listening to an interview that Frontline did with you. And when PBS partnered with NPR to do this documentary series, you did an interview with them, and ultimately you were beaten for that interview. Can you explain what happened to you this not long after you got to Serbia?
You know, when they came to interview me, I was in hunger strike on my 25 days. I spent 48 days in hunger strike protesting my condition, because the agreement between the United States government and the receiving countries, it was a resettlement agreement. But when we arrived at the hosting countries, they said, no, we had an agreement. We had a good contract to come here for 2 years. You live in our countries under restrictions. Nothing. You have no education, no courses. No. You know, they made us promises, especially in my case. I was recommendation to finish my college education. So I talked to my lawyer. I said, I cannot live here. I cannot stay here. I want to leave. So I went on a hunger strike when I was even one of the universities. I was accepted when they found out I came from Guantanamo. I was expelled. You know, this is one of the things that hurt me most after Guantanamo. So I went on hunger strike. When the frontline came here, the first we had, they went to the government. They said they were fine and they weren't doing well. When they came to see me, I was in hunger strike. They were surprised. The first time we had an interview. Then the second day, some people came to my apartment, took me down. They won't send me a message. Stop lying. You're lying. You're a liar. You're a liar, and so on. You know, and you know, I don't want to cause any problem, because I didn't want to expect. Because as you know, the Serbian, they have their history with Bosnia in the 1990s. Scary place. So then I disappear. Then I contacted my lawyer. I contacted the frontline. We continue again. And again, after the interview was aired, the Serbian newspaper really presented me in the worst way. Newspaper, TV, I was arrested, interrogated, threatened to be entrapped. You know, I wrote a lot about it, and you read it here. I don't want to talk much detail, because they're going to kick my ass again. But what I have learned at Guantanamo, I will never keep silence, you know, because keeping silence only gives the oppressor a mean to oppress you more. So I will never keep silence. I will, whatever they do, I will keep, you know, because I have done nothing wrong. Even if I have done something, there is a justice system. You cannot just beat people, arrest them, or target them because you have a power. So basically, yes, I mean, then in 2018, they came to me. They said, now that 2 years finished, you have the choice to go to Saudi jail or to go to the refugee camp. And that guy, his name is Nicola, told me, American f***ed you. The interview cost you a lot, literally word by word. And my lawyer was there. Listen to him. You're like, what? So, yes, what I talk about our life after Guantanamo, we still live in Guantanamo 2.0. You know, just let you know, Amy, I studied in another college. I will be graduating the 29th of September, and my thesis is about rehabilitation and reintegration of former Guantanamo detainees into social life and the labor market. I have been doing a lot of research for the last 5 years. I have interviewed around 150 brothers released from Guantanamo.
You can't leave Serbia, Mansoor.
Do you remember when I told you the worst pain that touched your soul? You know, I wanted to get married. I found really a woman that I thought she is going to be my wife. The only thing was like the piece of paper and a travel document where I can get married. So I couldn't travel, so I couldn't marry and finish. Not just me. I think I'm lucky. There are one of the brothers, Lutfi, he died last year. He had heart diseases. He was relocated from Kazakhstan to Mauritania, where they didn't have good health system. He needed to go to somewhere where can he be treated because he needed emergency surgery. And his doctor told him you have at least 6 months. So he needed $30,000 cash organized raised fund for him. And they said his surgery will be covered. He needed just a travel document, either travel to Tunisia or their country, just to have the surgery and get back. He lost his life. You know, it's one of the saddest moments. Like when I was talking to him, Martin Case, we talked to the ICRC, we talked to our human rights organization, to government. Nobody cares. Simply nobody cares.
Former Guantanamo prisoner Mansoor Adaifi, jailed at Guantanamo for 14 years, never charged. We'll be back with him in 30 seconds.
Rulers of nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell, and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying.
Is it for freedom, Sarah Thompson? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Mansoor Adaifi, jailed by the United States at Guantanamo for 14 years, author of the new memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. I asked him about reports that the Biden administration is considering holding Haitian refugees at Guantanamo.
They should help the countries to have some kind of stability so that people can live their life. Yeah, it's one of the biggest crises in the 21st century, the massive migration and refugees. So, but creating Guantanamo again, it brought us again what's going to happen to these people, how it's going to be treated. So I hope, I tweeted about it, and I don't want anyone to be detained in that place, especially the name of Guantanamo. I love Guantanamo. I have made peace with it. But the idea of Guantanamo, you know?
Well, let me ask, when you said, I have made peace with it, you held up your scarf that's orange, that's wrapped around your neck right now as you speak to us. You were forced to wear orange from head to toe. Why wear orange now?
I wear orange all the time. Because at Guantanamo, when the psychologist and the ICRC told me, wow, if you see the orange color, you'll say, you will be shocked. If you heard the known performer, I said, no, this is part of my life, and I will never let Guantanamo change me. So, alhamdulillah, I choose to fight for to close Guantanamo and to try to help anyone who wrongly detained or, strip his freedom. Because I don't want anyone to suffer the same fate I have suffered. Although I have made peace with Guantanamo. Yeah. I almost like every day talk about Guantanamo, write, talk, give interviews and so on. My other brothers, they don't want to remember because it's like a trauma. You traumatize yourself over and over again. But for me, I took it in another way. And alhamdulillah, I have some kind of strength. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave me strength. So I would use that strength to support those helpless people and also to bring the truth about Guantanamo. So I use my 441 in my emails, in my names, everywhere. And I use the orange color all the time. It also to bring the awareness to the people, the misuse of power, how can damage us as humans.
Finally, if you can talk about how you survived through Guantanamo, what hope meant for you, and was it hope that kept you going? Through the forced feedings, through the hunger strikes, through the beatings, through the torture, what got you through?
First of all, Amy, faith as Muslims. The first thing, we stick to our faith as Muslims, because before Guantanamo, I was studying Islamic Institute. That where I get the mission to go for research. So most of us, you know, even the U.S. government viewed us as terrorists or the faith a source of terrorism. It's not. First is our faith, stick to it, praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, knowing that everything in the hand of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and America has nothing to decide in our faith. Secondly, we had each other, because we were kept at that place. We had no books, nothing, just totally disconnected from the world outside. So we had only each other. I wrote about it. I wrote about it a piece called The Beautiful Guantanamo, which is, I just took all the bad things and I wrote about how we survived Guantanamo. Imagine, Amy, around 50 nationalities, 20 languages, different background. People who watched Guantanamo, they were artists, singers, doctors, nurses, divers, mafia, drug addicts, teachers, scholars, poets. That diversity of culture interacted with each other, melted, and formed what we call Guantanamo culture. We call it the beautiful Guantanamo. Imagine, I'm going to sing now, two songs, please. Imagine we used to had celebrate once a week, night. And just gave away a pain of being in jail. Try to have some kind of like to take our minds from being cages, torture, abuses. So we had one night a week, in a week to like in the black. So we just started singing Arabic, English, Pashto, Urdu, Farsi, French, all kind of languages, poets in different languages, stories, people dance from Yemen to Saudi Arabia, to rap, to all kind. It's like, imagine you hear in one block, 48 detainees, you heard those beautiful, you know, songs in different languages. It was captivating. They took that. However, the interrogators took it as a challenge. We didn't challenge them. We just tried to survive. This was a way of surviving because we had to lead each other. The things we brought with us at Guantanamo, whether our faith, whether our knowledge, our memories, our emotions, our relationship, who we are, help us to survive. We had only each other. Also, the guard was part of our survival because they play a role in that, by helping some of them, help sometimes in singing with us sometimes. Also, we had the art classes. I think you heard about the we especially in that time when we get access to classes, we paint. So those things help us to survive at that place. Hope also, hope it was a matter of life or death. You have to keep hoping. You know, that place was designed just to take the hope away so you can see the only hope is through the interrogators, through Americans. We said, no, it's not going to happen that way. So we had to support each other, try to stay alive. Also, we lost some brothers. And I lost very good brothers at that place. It's one of the, hardest and saddest moments at Guantanamo. And alhamdulillah, I managed. I don't know if I survived, to be honest with you, because someone asked me last month, I had an interview with the, I had an interview last month. Someone asked me, how did you spend your 20s and 30s? I said, I don't know. I don't know what does it mean, 20s or 30s. I am now at my late of my 30s, but I'm not free yet. So imagine I have a huge gap in our life, like 15 years, I'm going to know, 5 years now. And physically, you know, Technically, I feel like I'm 38, 39, but practically I feel like I'm still in my 20s, this mentality. You can see in my behavior, the way I talk, the way that's who I am actually. So there's a huge gap. And when I was released, different society, language, community, anyone and get interact or friend with get arrested, interrogated, people stay away from us. So because the stigma of Guantanamo. So basically, but I'm trying now, I'm trying to make a life, get married. Yeah, I can sing a song for you.
Yes, you said you'd sing too.
Yeah, the first one when we like supporting, because especially when General Miller arrived, he tried to crush us. The first day he arrived, he searched all of us, beat all of us. Cavity search, you know, they brought dogs, FC teams, pepper spray. It was like a message. I am here, those terrorists. I'm going to kick your ass. So, but at Guantanamo, we don't treat people with rank. It doesn't matter. The only thing we had with guard respect and for shit. This is simple as that. Not all of us, but a group of us. I'm sorry for these words, but I'm taking it. We are talking about Guantanamo. So because Guantanamo was designed to extract the worst of us. So when someone would go to the interrogation or for torture, we try to support him, you know, and we would sing for him. روح روح مع السلامة الله يزيدك أمن وسلامة روح روح مع السلامة الله يزيدك أمن وسلامة like around 40 it was like sometimes sing together collectively it was like give some encouraging.
And what did that mean? What did that mean?
He said روح روح مع السلامة go with peace. May Allah grant you more peace and safety. And when they came from appointment or interrogation or torture, or people came arrive at Guantanamo, new at Guantanamo, especially when the new group arrived at Guantanamo, we would welcome them in that songs. Imagine you just new arrived at Guantanamo, like three blocks, around 150 detainees, song for you. Haba, haba, billi ja, ya marhaba. باللي جاء باللي جاء حبا حبا باللي جاء باللي جاء يا مرحبا. It means welcome but the one who come. Imagine when the brothers first time arrived, you sing for them. They said, well, you know, it was like they were surprised. Are they detainees or they're like living in kind of beach like or something? One of the brothers used to tell us, we thought that you guys live in some kind of like lovely life and enjoying yourself. Then when they took the hood, whoa, it is cages. That's what they expect. He said, I heard the voice. I thought like everyone is happy singing. So we can like give them the first impression that everything's okay.
Mansoor, last two questions. One is you talked about the art classes that you took. Can you describe what art meant for you and what did you create? What did you draw?
You know, Amy, when we start negotiating with the Khan administration in 2010, we negotiate in 2009 and 10, we negotiated art class. The Khan commander said, art class? Your guy is terrorist. You don't have to paint. So we asked the brothers, can you paint, please? The second meeting, we showed them. They were shocked and surprised. They said, okay. It was a process, negotiation, asking over and over again. But alhamdulillah, you know, art class is one of the most important classes to go into now because it helps us to express ourselves. It was a mean way of escaping being in jail because you need to skip that feeling. So art connect us to the world outside. You can see the brothers, we paint, see trees, the things we missed most, sky, the stars, you know, homes, deserts, and so on. So arts actually help us to connect to our life that we almost forgot. The art connect us to ourselves because it brings that memories back. It connects us to each other. It connects us to the gods. You know, when someone saw arts, it kind of like mutual admiration and love and for arts. And some of the gods ask for the brothers to paint for them. They give them like art for gifts. Brothers used to teach gods art. Same thing, gods who has background, you teach brothers. Also, we, you know, in the art, one of the brothers, Sabri, one of the artists, and Khaled, I said, Khaled, how do you feel? He said, Mansoor, wallahi, when I paint, I saw myself in that painting, like in the hill, on the boat, on the ship, on the sea, sometime like running here and there. So he said, like, it just takes my mind and calms people down. And, you know, it was like a therapy too.
Mansoor, I wanted to ask you about your choice to have a woman voice your book. Usually it's the author when a book is done through audio that someone can listen to it. It's either the author or an actor. But you chose to have a woman read, voice, Don't Forget Us Here. Why?
Yeah, I remember when I was like talking to Sam from Hashtag. Hi, Sam, Antonio. And Julia, my agent, I said, guys, I need a woman. I want to read my book. No, why? It didn't happen before. You know, typically the man, I said, no, I want a woman to read my book. Monson, that doesn't make any sense. I said, what makes sense about Guantanamo? Nothing makes sense. I told him, plus, you know, men have been kidnapped. They tortured me, kicked my ass, imprisoned me. And like, they have done a lot of things, you know. The one who treated us, you know, nicely was woman. So I went to woman to read my book. So why not? At the same time, I told him it is like kind of racism against women. So first they sent me some kind of like men. I said, no, I want a woman to read my book. So when they found it was turned out good, they said, wow, this is a good idea. I said, no, I told you.
Former Guantanamo prisoner Mansour Adaifi, speaking from Belgrade, Serbia. He spent more than 14 years at Guantanamo, never charged. He just wrote his memoir. It's called Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. He now works at CAGE, an organization that advocates on behalf of victims of the so-called War on Terror. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Mike Burke and Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by Doug Henwood to talk about a recent article he wrote on the ruling class.
Who rules America? The most important question. Listen in, because Doug Henwood knows a lot about the answer.
Julian Assange's father, John Shipton, joins us with an update on his son's case.
John Shipton has been touring the United States, trying to save the life of his son, Julian Assange.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. In 1915, the great Irish socialist James Connolly said, "Oh yes, the ruling class are worthy of study. The natural history of the ruling class is a fascinating interest. You begin with interest, you proceed with awe and admiration, you deepen into hatred, and you wind up with contempt for the nature of the beast. You realize that the capitalist class is the meanest class that ever grasped the reins of power." Jacobin Magazine's spring 2021 issue is devoted entirely to an examination of the ruling class. We speak today with Doug Henwood, who has an article in Jacobin entitled, "Take Me to Your Leader, The Rot of the American Ruling Class." Doug Henwood is the editor of Left Business Review and the host of the radio program Behind the News. Doug Henwood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Always good to be here.
Doug, we need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. Who holds power now, and has this changed over the last 50 or 100 years?
Well, that's a pretty long topic, but I would say, in general, the ruling class of society consists of, it doesn't map easily onto the very rich. A lot of the very rich are just not that politically engaged or politically thoughtful. And certainly the preferences of the corporate class and Wall Street matter politically, but they also have to articulate with a political class that engages with the state and in political parties, the business wing of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is a problematic little assembly, so we can talk about that maybe a little bit later. But much of our politics does reflect the interest of the very rich, but they can't always articulate it directly, so they need a political class to develop an agenda for them. So elite politicians, Trump certainly did not qualify, but Obama certainly did. But also there's a kind of permanent political class of pundits and people who go in and out of government and the private sector. The famous revolving door where people go from lobbying to corporate positions to high government positions where they hand out favors and contracts and deregulate and do all those kinds of things that make businesses very happy. So, yeah, I think this partnership between the very rich but with a political class that really makes their rule possible. What's changed over the years is that there was once a much more coherent elite in the country, the old WASPs that ran things essentially from the founding of the country through probably the mid-70s, late 70s. They were, in just a sociological sense, a much more coherent formation than what we have now. They